kind of started, I mean, I'm learning, you know, because I have my feet up. And I kind of stepped right into the middle of the whole nugget situation, and I'm just like, oh, that's great.
Just what you want to do?
I know. And so the board's like, yeah, we think that could be something we've written. And I'm like, great.
Great.
I know, I said, Joel, I need some help. I don't know. So these processes have been in effect 8 months, and they wouldn't change it all.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know how that goes.
Yeah.
Test 1, 2. All right. Test 1, 2.
I'd like to call this meeting of the Carson City Historic Resources Commission for Thursday, April 9th, 2009 to order, beginning with determination of quorum. Call the roll.
Chairperson Drews.
Here.
Vice Chairperson Darney.
Here.
Commissioner Bass.
Here.
Commissioner Hayes.
Here.
Commissioner LaPiccolo.
Here.
Commissioner Ossa.
Here.
Commissioner Spalda.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Next item is B, action on approval of minutes. We have minutes from the March 12th, 2009 meeting. I entertain a motion.
So moved.
Motion, do I have a second?
Second.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved with one abstention. C, modification of agenda. This is the tentative schedule for the meeting. The Historic Resources Commission reserves the right to take items in a different order to accomplish business in the most efficient manner. Jen, is there any need to modify?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Commission members? Hearing none, we'll move to D, disclosures. Any member of the commission that may wish to explain any contact with the public regarding an item on the agenda or business of the commission. Are there any disclosures?
I had a conversation with you regarding the Nevada State Prison item.
And I had a conversation with the Nevada Appeal regarding the Nevada State Prison. Any other disclosures? Hearing none, we'll move to E, public comments. Members of the public who wish to address the commission may speak on matters related to the Historic Resources Commission. Comments are limited to 3 minutes per person. If your item requires extended discussion, please request the chairman to calendar the matter for a future meeting. No action may be taken on a matter raised under this item of the agenda until the matter itself has been specifically included on an agenda as an item upon which action may be taken. Are there any public comments on non-agendized items? Hearing none, move to F, public hearing matters. F1, HRC-07-087, action to consider an application from Ed and Maureen Waterhouse for historical tax deferment status on property zoned residential office, RO, located at 312 West Musser Street, APN 003-211-03. Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jennifer Pruitt, Planning Division. First off, I'd like to just touch on the process regarding tax deferments for those who are not aware of the process. Typically, a property owner submits an application to the Planning Division, and that application goes before this commission. And ultimately, this commission makes a decision, and that decision is forwarded on to the Board of Supervisors. If the Board of Supervisors approves the application, then the application is recorded, and ultimately the information gets back to the assessor's office, and that's usually where the process starts. So I just wanted to note that for the record. Typically, we process about one of these applications a year. I think there's approximately 42 tax deferments that are on the books currently. As you note, this is an application that was submitted in 2007, and there's a few reasons why the application hasn't been processed up until now. Actually, Mr. and Mrs. Waterhouse has been doing improvements to the property with the carriage house. They've done some fencing. A great deal of work has been done to the property, and typically these applications are not processed until all of the work has been completed on the property. And the other reason is there was a vinyl fencing that was installed, and the property owner, Mr. Waterhouse, took care of having the vinyl fencing replaced with the wood fencing product. So all of that's been done, and so now we're here to process the application. In the packet of information, there are four findings that are associated with tax deferments. The first finding is the property has to be listed on the Carson City Historic Survey, and this property has been listed on the March 1980 survey that was completed. Also, the property has to be in good repair. Staff conducted a site visit on March 20th and found the site to be in excellent condition. And the finding number three is any alteration of the property must be of compatible historic character. And at this time, the applicant's not proposing any alterations, but the alterations that have been completed are compatible. And the last finding is that the property must be in substantial compliance with the Historic Resources Commission guidelines. And as a result of our site visit on March 20th, staff found that the subject site is in compliance with the development standards and also the historic district guidelines. I have a few pictures of the property. I'd like to go through those if I could. And you've seen some of these pictures. Actually, this property last month was chosen for the 2009 Historic Preservation Award for Carson City, and these were the pictures that were submitted for that. So this is the subject property. It's the front of the property. You can clearly see the single-family dwelling unit and also the carriage house that was added recently. Carriage house. And also these fencing portions are the fencing that has been replaced with the wood product. And just another picture of the subject site. As far as staff is concerned, we sent out notices to the adjacent property owners, and we received no comments in writing regarding the tax deferment that's before you today. And I do see the property owner, Mr. Waterhouse, is here, and if you have any questions, you can address the questions to the property owner.
Thank you, Jen. Are there any commission member questions, comments?
I'd like to make a comment. You did a very nice job. It looks beautiful. One of these pictures in black and white, if the two cars were older cars, it would just fit perfect. Really, it look at them, you know, it's just, thank you.
Any other comments?
I'd like to add a comment that we all appreciate the addition to the neighborhood. It really adds to the character of our downtown core. Thank you.
Any others? I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve.
I'm sorry. Are there any public comments on this item?
Nothing yet.
Okay. Go ahead, Rob.
I'll make a motion to approve HRC 07-087, a request from Edward Waterhouse for historical tax deferment on property zone residential office located at 312 West Musser Street, APN 003-211-03, subject to approval, and the findings are in general conformance with the Secretary of Interior standards and the guidelines for rehabilitation, Carson City District guidelines, and the Historic Resources Commission policies.
Motion, do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much, Mr. Waterhouse. We hope to see you in a month or so. Is that right? May. To accept your reward. You did a great job. And Jen, thank you for putting together the open space background packet for us. Thank you very much. Can you, now you have to sign in and state your name. Glad you like it. Next item is H2, or F2, HRC 09-028, action to consider an application from Gary Kane to allow installation of a wood fencing material, 6 feet in overall height, 76 linear feet, on the western and southern portions of the subject site, and the installation of a decorative wood fencing material on the northeast and southeast portion of the subject site, 3 to 4 feet in overall height, approximately 174 linear feet, on property zoned downtown mixed use, located at 412 North Curry Street, APN 003-225-10. Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The subject site is the property commonly known as the Hyman Okovich House. The structure was built in 1876. And over the past few years, the applicant has improved the subject site exterior and interior significantly. There's been a great deal of work done to this property. At this time, the applicant is requesting to install fencing on the subject site. And I would like to clarify something. Within the application, the applicant included the height that they're proposing. And staff, we have confirmed with the applicant that the overall height that they're requesting will be 6 feet. So they will not be exceeding the 6 foot height.
Including the trellis.
Including the trellis, that is correct. So this slide that is on the screen right now, it basically shows you the two areas in which they're looking to install fencing. The areas in orange is where the 6 foot security fencing is being proposed, and that's the area that they're looking to create a child's play area for their infant daughter. And the area in green is where they're proposing the decorative fencing. And the applicant actually has included, I believe, three samples or examples of the fencing material that they're proposing. There is a range between 3 feet and 4 feet in overall height, but I believe there are examples right after the site plan in your packet, and there are 3 examples of the type of fencing that they're proposing. So this evening, the applicant is hoping that you will assist them in selecting a fencing that you feel is appropriate for the decorative element of the fencing. We did take some pictures, and these were taken just a few days ago. As you can see, this is the Hyman Okovich house. And in the picture, I tried to get the area in the front and also on the side because there's this concrete curbing. And the concrete...
I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve.
I'm sorry. Are there any public comments on this item?
Nothing yet.
Okay. Go ahead, Rob.
I'll make a motion to approve HRC 07-087, request from Edward Waterhouse for historical tax deferment on property zone residential office located at 312 West Musser Street, APN 003-211-03, subject to approval, and the findings are in general conformance of the Secretary of Interior standards and the guidelines for rehabilitation in Carson City District guidelines and the Historic Resources Commission policies.
Motion, do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much, Mr. Waterhouse. We hope to see you in a month or so. Is that right? May. To accept your reward. You did a great job. And Jen, thank you for putting together the open space background packet for us. Thank you very much. Can you now you have to sign in and state your name. Glad you like it. Next item is H2, or F2, HRC 09-028, action to consider an application from Gary Kane to allow installation of a wood fencing material, 6 feet in overall height, 76 linear feet, on the western and southern portions of the subject site, and the installation of a decorative wood fencing material on the northeast and southeast portion of the subject site, 3 to 4 feet in overall height, approximately 174 linear feet, on property zoned downtown mixed use, located at 412 North Curry Street, APN 003-225-10. Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The subject site is the property commonly known as the Hyman Okovich House. The structure was built in 1876, and over the past few years, the applicant has improved the subject site exterior and interior significantly. There's been a great deal of work done to this property. At this time, the applicant is requesting to install fencing on the subject site, and I would like to clarify something. Within the application, the applicant included the height that they're proposing. And staff, we have confirmed with the applicant that the overall height that they're requesting will be 6 feet. So they will not be exceeding the 6 foot height.
Including the trellis.
Including the trellis, that is correct. So this slide that is on the screen right now, it basically shows you the two areas in which they're looking to install fencing. The areas in orange is where the 6 foot security fencing is being proposed, and that's the area that they're looking to create a child's play area for their infant daughter. And the area in green is where they're proposing the decorative fencing. And the applicant actually has included, I believe, three samples or examples of the fencing material that they're proposing. There is a range between 3 feet and 4 feet in overall height, but I believe there are examples right after the site plan in your packet, and there are three examples of the type of fencing that they're proposing. So this evening, the applicant is hoping that you will assist them in selecting a fencing that you feel is appropriate for the decorative element of the fencing. We did take some pictures, and these were taken just a few days ago. As you can see, this is the Hyman Okovich house. And in the picture, I tried to get the area in the front and also on the side, because there's this concrete curbing, and the concrete curbing is where they're proposing to install the picket fencing. Will be installed on top of the concrete curbing, and I believe the applicant is going to install new curbing and eliminate the curbing that's in place. This slide, you can see the area that they're proposing for the security fencing, and that'll be in this area. We have another picture that shows the concrete curbing that wraps around the site. And you can see how it's on the front and also on the side of the subject property. This is a close-up of the concrete curbing. And we have one more picture that shows the rear of the property, where they're also proposing to install the 6-foot wood fencing material and trellis, and also install, I believe, some vines to soften the 6-foot fencing. We sent out notices to 4 adjacent properties within the area, and we've received no comments in favor or in opposition of the proposal that's before you today. There are some comments from the Building Division and also the Engineering Division. Specifically, the Building Division comments address if the fencing is going to exceed 6 feet in height, and it will not. And lastly, within the packet of information, I encourage you to assist the applicant in selecting a style of the decorative fencing for the 3 to 4 foot height on the front and the north of the subject site.
Thank you, Jim. Is there any commission member questions, comments?
I have a few thoughts. On the page that has the 4 examples of fences, I mean, certainly just to note, the 2 on the left are vinyl, but in terms of style, these are ones that you put together that kind of caught your eye or possibilities. The ones on the left are vinyl, but in terms of style, I mean, the top one is similar to what I have all found myself. Pardon? Oh, sure.
Okay, for the record, my name is Gary Kane, and I'm the applicant.
Anyhow, just in terms of style issues, I just I bought a wood product similar to what that upper left-hand one is, with the kind of that 6-foot. Yes. I mean, this is vinyl, I'm sure. Yes. But I know at Lowe's, as an example, I had a wood product very similar in style. And then the lower left one, I'm surprised to see. I happen to own that property, and I'm looking forward to tearing down that vinyl fence. But I've not seen a wood product exactly shaped like that. You probably could make ones like that if you wanted to, but as long as it's wood, that's what I'm looking forward to putting in on that particular site.
Yeah, basically we tried to find anything that would be suitable, and even the trellis that's available from either Meeks or Lowe's is fairly low quality. So this is the kind of material that we're going to be using. This is poplar. We might use this. We might use something else that's even better. We're not sure yet. The whole idea is to make this thing pretty close to bomb-proof. So the trellis stuff that's available at Lowe's is very flexible, and it's kind of poor quality. And then we aren't going to have vinyl. So it will definitely be wood, and it'll be a high-quality wood. So, because I want it to last for about 30 years.
I'm very happy to hear the no vinyl thing. And
yeah,
I'm the most passionate guy about that. But in terms of the Lowe's thing, though, you can special order better quality versions of the things they have on the floor. There is sort of a bit of a gradation, but it tends to be redwood and not bomb-proof, I suppose.
Yeah.
A little, you know, softer wood.
Yeah. So, but yeah, basically we're going to build it on site, and then the trellis will build on site as well. And so it'll be either this thick. What we're going to do is we're going to build the 5-foot section first, and then we're going to see what is most aesthetically pleasing. We might, I don't think we'll go wider than this, but we might go thinner than this, because the whole idea is to make it look good and have it kind of blend in. And then, like Jennifer Pruitt mentioned, we've got Virginia creepers that are already on the property and grapes as well. We're going to run those on up and then fan them out through the trellis pattern. And so that'll basically soften that whole look. So,
any other commission member questions?
Just that curbing is where they're proposing to install the picket fencing. Will be installed on top of the concrete curbing, and I believe the applicant is going to install new curbing and eliminate the curbing that's in place. This slide, you can see the area that they're proposing for the security fencing, and that'll be in this area. We have another picture that shows the concrete curbing that wraps around the site. And you can see how it's on the front and also on the side of the subject property. This is a close-up of the concrete curbing. And we have one more picture that shows the rear of the property, where they're also proposing to install the 6-foot wood fencing material and trellis, and also install, I believe, some vines to soften the 6-foot fencing. We sent out notices to 4 adjacent properties within the area, and we've received no comments in favor or in opposition of the proposal that's before you today. There are some comments from the building division and also the engineering division. Specifically, the building division comments address if the fencing is going to exceed 6 feet in height, and it will not. And lastly, within the packet of information, I encourage you to assist the applicant in selecting a style of the decorative fencing for the 3 to 4 foot height on the front and the north of the subject site.
Thank you, Jen. Is there any commission member questions, comments?
I have a few thoughts. On the page that has the 4 examples of fences, I mean, certainly just to note, the 2 on the left are vinyl, but in terms of style, these are ones that you put together that kind of caught your eye or possibilities. I mean, the ones on the left are vinyl, but in terms of style, I mean, the top one is similar to what I've all found myself. Pardon? Oh, sure.
Okay, for the record, my name is Gary Kane, and I'm the applicant.
Anyhow, just in terms of style issues, I just I bought a wood product similar to what that upper left-hand one is with the kind of that 6-foot.
Yes.
I mean, this is vinyl, I'm sure. But I know at Lowe's, as an example, I had a wood product very similar in style. And then the lower left one, I'm surprised to see. I happen to own that property, and I'm looking forward to tearing down that vinyl fence. But I've not seen a wood product exactly shaped like that. You probably could make ones like that if you wanted to, but as long as it's wood, that's what I'm looking forward to putting in on that particular site.
Yeah, basically we tried to find anything that would be suitable, and even the trellis that's available from either Meeks or Lowe's is fairly low quality. So this is the kind of material that we're going to be using. This is poplar. We might use this. We might use something else that's even better. We're not sure yet. The whole idea is to make this thing pretty close to bomb-proof. So the trellis stuff that's available at Lowe's is very flexible, and it's kind of poor quality. And then we aren't going to have vinyl. So it will definitely be wood, and it'll be a high-quality wood. So, because I want it to last for about 30 years.
I'm very happy to hear the no vinyl thing. And
yeah,
I'm the most passionate guy about that. But in terms of the Lowe's thing, though, you can special order better quality versions of the things they have on the floor.
Yeah.
There is sort of a bit of gradation, but it tends to be redwood and
right,
not bomb-proof, I suppose.
Yeah.
A little, you know, softer wood.
Yeah. So, but yeah, basically we're going to build it on site, and then the trellis will build on site as well. And so it'll be either this thick. What we're going to do is we're going to build the 5-foot section first, and then we're going to see what is most aesthetically pleasing. I don't think we'll go wider than this, but we might go thinner than this, because the whole idea is to make it look good and have it kind of blend in. And then, like Jennifer Pruitt mentioned, we've got Virginia creepers that are already on the property and grapes as well. We're going to run those on up and then fan them out through the trellis pattern, and so that'll basically soften that whole look. So,
any other commission member questions?
Just that, you know, either any of these designs, I think, would be complementary to that house. So, that's my only comment.
I can't remember on the front porch. Were they just straight 2x2s?
Yes.
Or did they have a route on them or anything? Or?
There's a little bit of a route on the corners.
I would go with just the 2x2 simple picket fence.
Yeah.
You know, with a little pointed cap on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, we could do.
That would be.
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to. What I did was I drove kind of the neighborhood looking to find stuff that was kind of similar to the East Lake style.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only ones that I found that were similar to the style.
Yeah, so. I think simple would look really nicer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you think maybe all the same height, not the alternating. Right, a little bit bigger, but the runs, I guess, the same height.
There's one in town, I can't remember where.
Yeah.
Two by two with a little.
Very simple. Yeah.
Just one other comment. If you're going to make your own, I make my own pickets. I mean, next door to this example, of 4th and Minnesota, is my little pointed picket ones. The varying qualities as I got better. But but now I have it down, I'm telling you.
Okay.
So, and I did notice going around in terms of height, you said 3 or 4 feet.
Right.
Somewhere around that 42-inch point is quite common. So something like that.
So you want it to be more common or less common?
At some point, it looks kind of not as inviting and more like a prison.
You know,
as it gets too tall. So
right. Well, also
right around there is a common choice.
Right, and then we also we are going to replace the curbing around there, because the curbing is made out of cement and it's in a pretty advanced state of collapse. And so we're not sure how high that's going to be yet. So it'll be somewhere between 6 and 7 inches probably, and then the wood will be on top of that. So yeah, basically we're going to try and just make everything blend in as best as possible.
Comment from the new commissioner? This is Derbass, for the record.
Mm-hmm.
On your front elevation or front view of your house on the porch, there's a decorative molding on the cornice.
Yes.
You might want to try to echo that as the caps of your picket fence there by picking up some of that architectural style on the house and reflecting that in the fence. Just a suggestion.
So flipping that?
Yeah.
The caps?
Yeah. Or put some of
that. Any other commission member comments?
Yeah, actually might look good.
My biggest concern was the height of that security fence. And I'm really glad you went down to 6, because it just tones it down.
Yeah, I got aggressive. Yeah.
Is that going to be painted? Are you going to paint that or leave it natural color?
The goal, well, I think we're going to paint it.
I believe we're going to paint it to match the pickets that are on the porch. So we'll kind of carry that same theme throughout. So.
I got one other comment.
I just want to say I agree with the all things have been said, and the most important to me really is that height.
Yeah.
The not so much the security fence, that's been resolved at 6 feet, but the one in the front, I think you're right, it needs to be, I think, closer to 3 feet than 4, mostly because if it's too tall, it'll dominate that front
with
pickets.
And yeah, because we're going to replace the handrails and also those steps, because those are in an advanced
that way at 3 feet or so, it tends to be in harmony with your railing and tend to look like it's all part of one contiguous design.
Yeah, no, that's the whole point. I mean, we want it to look good. So, any other questions?
That's 3 feet for the fence and six to seven for the curb. So 42 to 43 finish height. Okay.
Can do.
Any other commission member questions, comments, public comment?
Let's see here.
Oh, no.
The jet block previous tenant, the fence was about this high originally in the back, and it was 2x2 pickets, and it's much like the Wrinkle Mansion. And it had about a 6 or 8 inch rot board at the bottom where it went across on top of the concrete. And the fence came to the, on the three windows to the back corner there, and that was an addition. The back corner was in the 1968 addition, but the fence was there, and it was the whole back parking lot, and it was 4 or 5 feet high, and then it had the pickets, and they were very similar to the wrinkle, and then they had the posts coming up where the
either any of these designs I think would be complementary to that house. So that's my only comment.
I can't remember on the front porch, were they just straight 2x2s?
Yes.
Or did they have a route on them or anything? Or?
There's a little bit of a route on the corners.
Probably so. That was just the 2x2 simple picket fence.
Yeah.
You know, with a little pointed cap on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, we could do...
That would be...
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to... What I did was I drove kind of the neighborhood looking to find stuff that was kind of similar to the East Lake style.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only ones that I found that were similar to the style.
Yeah, so. I think simple would look really nicer.
Yeah.
So you think maybe all the same height, not the alternating...
Right,
a little bit bigger, but the runs, I guess, the same height.
There's one in town, I can't remember where.
Yeah.
It's a 2x2 with a
very simple. Yeah.
Wrinkle Mansion.
Yeah.
Is that it? Okay.
Just one other comment. If you're going to make your own, I make my own pickets. I mean, next door to this example, 4th in Minnesota, is my little pointed picket ones. They're varying qualities as I got better, but now I have it down, I'm telling you.
Okay.
So, and I did notice going around in terms of height, you said 3 or 4 feet.
Right.
Somewhere around that 42 inch point is quite common. So, something like that.
So, you want it to be more common or less common?
At some point, it looks kind of not as inviting and more like a prison.
You know,
as it gets too tall. So,
Well, also
right around there is a common choice.
Right, and then we also have we are going to replace the curbing around there because the curbing is made out of cement and it's in a pretty advanced state of collapse, and so we're not sure how high that's going to be yet. So it'll be somewhere between 6 and 7 inches probably, and then the wood will be on top of that. So yeah, basically we're going to try and just make everything blend in as best as possible.
Comment from the new commissioner? This is Derbass, for the record.
Mm-hmm.
On your front elevation or front view of your house on the porch, there's a decorative molding on the cornice.
Yes.
You might want to try to echo that as the caps of your picket fence there by picking up some of that architectural style on the house and reflecting that in the fence. Just a suggestion.
So flipping that?
Yeah.
The caps?
Yeah. Or put some of
these. Any other commission member comments?
Yeah, actually might look good.
My biggest concern was the height of that security fence. And I'm really glad you went down to 6 because it just tones it down.
Yeah, I got aggressive. Yeah.
Is that going to be painted? Are you going to paint that or leave it natural color?
The goal, I
believe we're going to paint it to match the pickets that are on the porch. So we'll kind of carry that same theme throughout. So.
I got one other comment.
I just want to say I agree with the all things have been said, and the most important to me really is that height.
Yeah.
The not so much the security fence, that's been resolved at 6 feet, but the one in the front, I think you're right, it needs to be, I think, closer to 3 feet than 4, mostly because if it's too tall, it'll dominate that front
with all those pickets.
And
yeah, because we're going to replace the handrails and also those steps because those are in an advanced
That way at 3 feet or so, it tends to be
in harmony with your railing and tend to look like it's all part of one contiguous design.
Yeah, no, that's the whole point. I mean, we want it to look good. So, any other questions?
That's 3 feet for the fence and six to seven for the curb, so 42 to 43 finish height.
Okay. Can do.
Any other commission member questions, comments, public comment?
Let's see here.
Oh, no.
the jet block previous tenant, the fence was about this high originally in the back, and it was 2x2 pickets, and it's much like the Wrinkle Mansion, and it had about a 6 or 8 inch rot board at the bottom where it went across on top of the concrete, and the fence came to the on the three windows to the back corner there, and that was an addition. The back corner was in the 1968 addition, but the fence was there, and it was the whole back parking lot, and it was 4 or 5 feet high, and then it had the pickets, and they were very similar to the wrinkle, and then they had the posts coming up where the gates were, and the gates were about 4 feet wide, I guess. Mm-hmm. So when you do something like this, are you trying to go after what the late last fence was or what predominantly might have been there originally? I mean, we're talking that fence that I know of was there probably 1928 to whenever the Cactus Jacks bought it. But is that a consideration, or is wood just more the important factor in the height?
It's the fence was obviously added after the building was constructed. It's an additional element. We can play it either way. If we want to be faithful to the 1920s look of the house, then yeah, you could make the case that that's what we should have. In this case, I'm not sure that it matters that much. It's just it's basically a temporary addition that fits the architectural style. We're not trying to replicate a period.
So whatever period you want to choose, if you wanted to, or otherwise the most main concern would be the height and the product would be wood.
I agree with that, Mike, that because it wasn't we don't know what the original fence, if there was a fence, and that would be the only historical significance. After that, it's a matter of the time period, 1928, let's say, the owner would have had five styles to choose from at that time, too, and he picked this one or whatever one you're describing. And my opinion is if it's historically accurate for the period with the style, then it's an acceptable solution for me.
You're looking for compatibility with the architectural style so that there could be a big range. I mean, when you look at the Sears catalog, I mean, there's a lot of fences for a particular period, and so you just pick and choose and kind of what's pleasing to the eye and to the scale and the massing of the house and the architectural detailing.
I always like to fall back to if my dad saw in a movie, would he point it out and say, that's not the right time period for that piece of equipment.
Are there any other public comments? Hearing none, I'll entertain.
Can you turn your... There. Okay. I'm his neighbor to the south, and my name's Marilyn Pruitt Harper, and I grew up next door to that house. I was born and raised at 402 Curry next door, so I know all about that back fence. But listen, this is the period of change, so I think he's done a real good job. He didn't ask me, but that's okay. The only thing that makes me happy is I'm not going to have his grapes and that stuff interfering in my parking lot, and then he gets mad at me when I have it trimmed. So we're going to have a lot more harmony, I think, with that fence. So I am glad he's having it done. But I do remember when you say 1928, I mean, I'm going to tell you my age because I was born in 25, and Gene Sanford and I were the closest friends. And I know everything about that house and probably stuff he doesn't know about.
Oh, I hope so. But you better write it down.
It would make a great story, I'll tell you, because that was a very wonderful house back then, and was owned by people that were very interesting people, the Sanford family. So that was, I didn't really think I was going to say anything, but then when they started talking about 1928 and stuff, I thought, well, gee, you got somebody here that knows all about 1928. The only thing that I miss about the house is when they took out the, in the front of the house where they have the railings that go up the stairs, we used to have the cement that came down like a stair. Oh, we used to have such fun sliding down that thing. That was great.
It was. We're not going to put that up.
Well, and the banisters in the house, too. We used to have a lot of fun on those banisters.
Those are still there.
Yep.
Get in trouble.
Okay, thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Can you... any other public comment? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Okay. I move to approve HRC 09028, a request from Gary Kane for the installation of a wood fencing material, 6 feet in overall height, approximately 76 linear feet on the western and southern portions of the subject site, and installation of the decorative wood fencing material on the northeast and southeastern portion of the subject site, 3 to 4 feet in overall height, approximately 174 linear feet on property zoned downtown mixed use, located at 412 North Curry Street, APN.
And the gates were about 4 feet wide, I guess. Mm-hmm. So when you do something like this, are you trying to go after what the late last fence was or what predominantly might have been there originally? I mean, we're talking that fence that I know of was there probably 1928 to whenever the Cactus Jacks bought it. But is that a consideration, or is wood just more the important factor in the height?
It's the fence was obviously added after the building was constructed. It's an additional element. We can play it either way. If we want to be faithful to the 1920s look of the house, then yeah, you could make the case that that's what we should have. In this case, I'm not sure that it matters that much. It's just it's basically a temporary addition that fits the architectural style. We're not trying to replicate a period.
So whatever period you want to choose, if you wanted to, or otherwise the most main concern would be the height and the product would be wood.
I agree with that, Mike, that because it wasn't we don't know what the original fence, if there was a fence, and that would be the only historical significance. After that, it's a matter of the time period, 1928, let's say, the owner would have had five styles to choose from at that time, too. And he picked this one, or whatever one you're describing. And my opinion is if it's historically accurate for the period with the style, then it's an acceptable solution for me.
You're looking for compatibility with the architectural style, so that there could be a big range. I mean, when you look at the Sears catalog, I mean, there's a lot of fences for a particular period, and so you just pick and choose and kind of what's pleasing to the eye and to the scale and the massing of the house and the architectural detailing.
I always like to fall back to, if my dad saw in a movie, would he point it out and say, that's not the right time period for that piece of equipment.
Are there any other public comments? Hearing none, I'll entertain.
Okay. I'm his neighbor to the south, and my name's Marilyn Pruitt Harper, and I grew up next door to that house. I was born and raised at 402 Curry next door, so I know all about that back fence. But listen, this is the period of change, so I think he's done a real good job. He didn't ask me, but that's okay. The only thing that makes me happy is I'm not going to have his grapes and that stuff interfering in my parking lot, and then he gets mad at me when I have it trimmed. So we're going to have a lot more harmony, I think, with that fence. So I am glad he's having it done. But I do remember when you say 1928, I mean, I'm going to tell you my age, because I was born in 25, and Gene Sanford and I were the closest friends. And I know everything about that house and probably stuff he doesn't know about.
Oh, I'd hope so. But you better write it down.
It would make a great story, I'll tell you, because that was a very wonderful house back then, and was owned by people that were very interesting people, the Sanford family. So that was, I didn't really think I was going to say anything, but then when they started talking about 1928 and stuff, I thought, well, gee, you got somebody here that knows all about 1928. The only thing that I miss about the house is when they took out the, in the front of the house where they have the railings that go up the stairs, we used to have the cement that came down like a stair. Oh, we used to have such fun sliding down that thing. That was great. It was.
We're not going to put that up.
Well, and the banisters in the house, too. We used to have a lot of fun on those banisters.
Those are still there.
Yep.
You're in trouble.
Okay, thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Can you... Any other public comment? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Okay. I move to approve HRC 09028, a request from Gary Kane for the installation of a wood fencing material, 6 feet in overall height, approximately 76 linear feet on the western and southern portions of the subject site, and installation of the decorative wood fencing material on the northeast and southeastern portion of the subject site, 3 to 4 feet in overall height, approximately 174 linear feet on property zoned downtown mixed use, located at 412 North Curry Street, APN 003-225-10, subject to the conditions of approval contained in the staff report. This approval is based on the understanding that any stipulations to the commission by the applicant may be considered as conditions to the approval.
Motion, do I have a second?
I'll second.
Motion and a second. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Gary, and have fun.
Oh, yeah.
Next item is F3, presentation by the District Attorney's Office regarding the Nevada open meeting law. Jen, you want to introduce it, or Joel, you want to just... jump in.
I'll jump in and introduce myself. My name is Joel Benton. I am a senior deputy district attorney at the district attorney's office. About every year, the members of the DA's office go to the various boards and commissions just to sort of give a refresher course, or for new commissioners like Commissioner Bass, an intro course into the open meeting law, which is sort of what governs how you conduct actions and conduct your deliberations toward actions. Let me start off by saying when the legislature passed the open meeting law, it declared that all public bodies exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business, and therefore it is the intent of the law that actions be taken openly and that deliberations be conducted openly. So that's the guiding principle behind the open meeting law, is that that you're here to conduct the public's business, and it must be done before the public, and what you consider and what you discuss when doing the public's business must also be done in front of the public. The open meeting law applies to public bodies. The NRS defines public bodies as a body that owes its existence to a state or local government, is organized to act in an administrative, advisory, executive, or legislative capacity, must perform a government function, and must expend, disperse, or be supported by tax dollars. Under that definition, the Historic Resources Commission meets the definition of a public body and therefore is subject to the open meeting law. Who is not a public body or bodies headed by one person or staff. For example, Jennifer is not a public body, and so she's not governed by the open meeting law. You'd be surprised. There are some exceptions to the open meeting law, and generally exceptions must be narrowly construed. Exceptions are judicial proceedings, the legislature, the ethics commissions, labor negotiations. Additionally, meetings between a public body and their attorneys to discuss litigation is also not subject to the open meeting law. The open meeting applies, when there is a gathering of members of the public body. The gathering must be equal to a quorum, and at the quorum of the public body must either deliberate towards a decision or take action. They have determined that deliberation towards a decision includes taking in information that relates to a decision that you could make. So even a presentation about a topic that was not necessarily an action item before the commission, but would relate to the business of the commission, could be considered deliberation because it could become before the commission in a future time. So if there's a quorum of you present, then and someone was making a presentation towards the business of the commission, that would be a meeting that would need to comply with the open meeting law. Another example is serial communications. This is when there's a gathering of less than a quorum, but there are multiple meetings between members who are less than a quorum, at which point the discussion between the meetings is enough members to equal a quorum of the commission. A good example are emails, discussions via emails, discussions being telephone, where if the commissioner were to call each of you and to want to discuss an action item, he'd only speak to one of you at a time, so there wouldn't be a quorum at a particular time. But by talking to each of you individually, you'd have a serial communication, which would create a quorum, and that would violate the open meeting law.
Joel, if it stays under the quorum level, is it still considered a violation? If we call three rather than four?
If it's not a quorum, that's one of the exceptions, private briefings to a non-quorum. So if three of you, for example, there's seven of you, so if three of you were to get together and discuss an item and did not then go forward and discuss the item with other members of the commission, you wouldn't have made a quorum there. You wouldn't, therefore, wouldn't have a public meeting or a meeting that had to meet the open meeting law. Were your commission to meet with a via teleconference that could constitute a quorum, even if it was over
0032251 0, subject to the conditions of approval contained in the staff report. This approval is based on the understanding that any stipulations to the commission by the applicant may be considered as conditions to the approval.
Motion, do I have a second?
I'll second.
Motion and a second. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Gary, and have fun.
Oh, yeah.
Next item is F3, presentation by the District Attorney's Office regarding the Nevada Open Meeting Law. Jen, you want to introduce it, or Joel, you want to just jump in?
I'll jump in and introduce myself. My name is Joel Benton. I am a senior deputy district attorney at the district attorney's office. About every year, the members of the DA's office go to the various boards and commissions just to sort of give a refresher course, or for new commissioners like Commissioner Bass, an intro course into the open meeting law, which is sort of what governs how you conduct actions and conduct your deliberations toward actions. Let me start off by saying when the legislature passed the open meeting law, it declared that all public bodies exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business, and therefore it is the intent of the law that actions be taken openly and that deliberations be conducted openly. So that's the guiding principle behind the open meeting law, is that that you're here to conduct the public's business, and it must be done before the public, and what you consider and what you discuss when doing the public's business must also be done in front of the public. The open meeting law applies to public bodies. The NRS defines public bodies as a body that owes its existence to a state or local government, is organized to act in an administrative, advisory, executive, or legislative capacity, must perform a government function, and must expend, disperse, or be supported by tax dollars. Under that definition, the Historic Resources Commission meets the definition of a public body and therefore is subject to the open meeting law. Who is not a public body or bodies headed by one person or staff. For example, Jennifer is not a public body, and so she's not governed by the open meeting law. You'd be surprised. There are some exceptions to the open meeting law, and generally exceptions must be narrowly construed. Exceptions are judicial proceedings, the legislature, the ethics commissions, labor negotiations. Additionally, meetings between a public body and their attorneys to discuss litigation is also not subject to the open meeting law. The open meeting applies, when there is a gathering of members of the public body. The gathering must be equal to a quorum, and at the quorum of the public body must either deliberate towards a decision or take action. They have determined that deliberation towards a decision includes taking in information that relates to a decision that you could make. So even a presentation about a topic that was not necessarily an action item before the commission, but would relate to the business of the commission, could be considered deliberation because it could become before the commission in a future time. So if there's a quorum of you present, then and someone was making a presentation towards the business of the commission, that would be a meeting that would need to comply with the open meeting law. Another example is serial communications. This is when there's a gathering of less than a quorum, but there are multiple meetings between members who are less than a quorum, at which point the discussion between the meetings is enough members to equal a quorum of the commission. A good example are emails, discussions via emails, discussions being telephone, where if the commissioner were to call each of you and to want to discuss an action item, he'd only speak to one of you at a time, so there wouldn't be a quorum at a particular time. But by talking to each of you individually, you'd have a serial communication, which would create a quorum, and that would violate the open meeting law.
Joel, if it stays under the quorum level, is it still considered a violation? If we call three rather than four?
If it's not a quorum, that's one of the exceptions, private briefings to a non-quorum. So if three of you, for example, there's seven of you, so if three of you were to get together and discuss an item and did not then go forward and discuss the item with other members of the commission, you wouldn't have made a quorum there. You wouldn't, therefore, wouldn't have a public meeting or a meeting that had to meet the open meeting law. Were your commission to meet with a via teleconference that could constitute a quorum, even if it was over speakerphone? There are occasions when some commission members, not on this one, but on other commissions, will call in and participate in a meeting over the telephone. That is permitted, but it's considered an open meeting. Meetings held out of state. If the Historic Resources Commission were to have a joint meeting with the Board of Supervisors, that would also constitute a meeting of both of the bodies and would need to be treated as such. Exceptions are social gatherings. As long as the quorum of you at a social gathering aren't discussing or deliberating towards a decision involving the Historic Resources Commission. So if you happen to stumble across each other at the wine walk, you shouldn't be worried about the open meeting law. Just be careful of what you discuss amongst yourselves. When there's going to be a meeting of a public body, there needs to be notice of the meeting. The notice is the agenda. The agenda lists the time, the place, the location, and a list of locations where the notice was published. The agenda must have a clear and complete statement of the topics of which are going to be discussed. But there can be too much detail. If you provide too much detail, then the commission doesn't have the flexibility to address what an action that may be relevant to the agenda topic but wouldn't fall within the language of the agenda topic is presented on the agenda. That's why you'll see, for example, it's an action on F2, for example, it's an action to consider an application from Gary Kane as opposed to an action to approve an application for Gary Kane, because then you have the flexibility to take whatever action is necessary on his application. The items upon which you are going to take action have to be notified as such. So again, back to F2, it specifically says action to consider an application. Under this agenda item, there is no action, so the word action is not used. For the most part, staff is the one who takes care of preparing it, and they're very good at knowing the rules, but I just thought I would give the commission sort of a little background on how the agenda is put together. There must be a notice on the agenda that staff will help members of the public who need special assistance. There needs to be notice that if you're going to take items out of order, that the commission reserves that right. You can place reasonable time limits on public discussion. For example, this is 3 minutes. If you look at a Board of Supervisors agenda, there is no time limit on how long a member of the public can speak. The notice must be posted in 4 places within the jurisdiction, so 4 places within Carson City, and it must be posted 3 days before the meeting, and it must be mailed 3 days before the meeting to anyone who's requested that the agenda be mailed to them. I don't know if anyone in particular has requested it. No. Not this agenda. I think there's plenty who request the planning agenda. It must be posted on the internet if we maintain an internet website. If this commission, and this doesn't really apply to this commission, but if a public body is going to discuss the character, misconduct, or professional competence of a person during a commission meeting, they have to provide either 5 or 21 days notice, depending if it's personal or mailed, to the person that person's character, misconduct, competence, or physical or mental health is going to be considered. And then you also must provide notice if you're going to take administrative action against that person. During the conduct of the meeting, you need to stick to the agenda. Straying off the agenda opens up you to open meeting law complaints because the public only knows what you've agendized. And so if you leave the agenda and talk about other subjects or deliberate or discuss other subjects, then the public has a complaint that they didn't have notice that that was going to be discussed, and it may have been a matter in which they had interest and they would have liked to have participated in the discussion. Matters brought up during public comment, for example, the public comment of non-agendized items, you may comment on them, but you can't take action on them, and you can't deliberate towards a decision on them. Your regulation of the comments must be content neutral, so you can't pick and choose. You can't say, I like what you're saying, so you get more than 3 minutes. I don't like what you're saying. You're cut off at 1 minute. The meeting room must be large enough to accommodate the public, and they must be feel comfortable to enter. For the most part, public meetings occur in our community center, and so that is probably one of the better places to have it. During the public comment section, the chairman and the commission is allowed to establish reasonable rules. You don't have to put up with verbal abuse. Disruptive people can be removed, and the public is allowed to record as long as it's not disruptive. When you're voting on an microphone, there are occasions when some commission members, not on this one, but on other commissions, will call in and participate in a meeting over the telephone. That is permitted, but is considered an open meeting. Meetings held out of state. If the Historic Resources Commission were to have a joint meeting with the Board of Supervisors, that would also constitute a meeting of both of the bodies and would need to be treated as such. Exceptions are social gatherings. As long as the quorum of you at a social gathering aren't discussing or deliberating towards a decision involving the Historic Resources Commission. So if you happen to stumble across each other at the wine walk, you shouldn't be worried about the open meeting law. Just be careful of what you discuss amongst yourselves. When there's going to be a meeting of a public body, there needs to be notice of the meeting. The notice is the agenda. The agenda lists the time, the place, the location, and a list of locations where the notice was published. The agenda must have a clear and complete statement of the topics of which are going to be discussed. But there can be too much detail. If you provide too much detail, then the commission doesn't have the flexibility to address what an action that may be relevant to the agenda topic but wouldn't fall within the language of the agenda topic as presented on the agenda. That's why you'll see, for example, it's an action on F2, for example, it's an action to consider an application from Gary Kane as opposed to an action to approve an application for Gary Kane, because then you have the flexibility to take whatever action is necessary on his application. The items upon which you are going to take action have to be notified as such. So again, back to F2, it specifically says action to consider an application. Under this agenda item, there is no action, so the word action is not used. For the most part, staff is the one who takes care of preparing it, and they're very good at knowing the rules. But I just thought I would give the commission sort of a little background on how the agenda is put together. There must be a notice on the agenda that staff will help members of the public who need special assistance. There needs to be notice that if you're going to take items out of order, that the commission reserves that right. You can place reasonable time limits on public discussion. For example, this is 3 minutes. If you look at a Board of Supervisors agenda, there is no time limit on how long a member of the public can speak. The notice must be posted in 4 places within the jurisdiction, so 4 places within Carson City, and it must be posted 3 days before the meeting, and it must be mailed 3 days before the meeting to anyone who's requested that the agenda be mailed to them. I don't know if anyone in particular has requested it. No. Not this agenda. I think there's plenty who request the planning agenda. It must be posted on the internet if we maintain an internet website. If this commission, and this doesn't really apply to this commission, but if a public body is going to discuss the character, misconduct, or professional competence of a person during a commission meeting, they have to provide either 5 or 21 days notice, depending if it's personal or mailed, to the person that person's character, misconduct, competence, or physical or mental health is going to be considered. And then you also must take provide notice if you're going to take administrative action against that person. Um, During the conduct of the meeting, you need to stick to the agenda. Straying off the agenda opens up you to open meeting law complaints because the public only knows what you've agendized. And so if you leave the agenda and talk about other subjects or deliberate or discuss other subjects, then the public has a complaint that they didn't have notice that that was going to be discussed, and it may have been a matter in which they had interest and they would have liked to have participated in the discussion. Matters brought up during public comment, for example, the public comment of non-agendized items, you may comment on them, but you can't take action on them, and you can't deliberate towards a decision on them. Your regulation of the comments must be content neutral, so you can't pick and choose. You can't say, I like what you're saying, so you get more than 3 minutes. I don't like what you're saying. You're cut off at 1 minute. The meeting room must be large enough to accommodate the public, and they must feel comfortable to enter. For the most part, public meetings occur in our community center, and so that is probably one of the better places to have it. During the public comment section, the chairman and the commission is allowed to establish reasonable rules. You don't have to put up with verbal abuse. Disruptive people can be removed, and the public is allowed to record as long as it's not disruptive. When you're voting on an action item, there's no secret balloting. All voting must be done in public. The rule is that it's a majority of the quorum. There's a separate rule for if the public body is all elected officials, and then it's a majority of the entire body. So, for example, if the Board of Supervisors has 3 members show up, which constitute a quorum, to take action, all 3 would have to vote on the same side. Whereas in this case, a quorum would be 4, and it would be a majority of the quorum to take action for the Historic Resources Commission. We're required to take minutes of the meeting. The minutes are considered to be public records, and they're must be reasonably made available within 30 days. And the meeting must be recorded. That's why it's important to have your mics on when you talk. Does anybody have any questions? If not, that ends my presentation.
Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Next item is F4, HRC 09-027, presentation and action to provide comments to the Nevada State Prison and State Public Works Board, SPWB, regarding the Nevada State Prison Warden's House possible demolition, owner State of Nevada, Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, 3301 East 5th Street, APN 010-041-55. Is that the right property owner? Conservation and Natural Resources owns the
I believe so.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I actually have just a few slides that I wanted to go through, and that way then you can do your presentation if that's okay.
Yeah, Jen, if you want, after you're done with yours, if you go to the CD, there's some historic photos too of the prison that the commission might like.
So regarding the subject site, this is the prison property. This is 5th Street, and this is the gate area, and the warden's house is located right in this area. We tried to get an aerial photo to show you where the location of the structure was. But we do have a few pictures. This is of the front of the warden's house. Another picture of the front. And this is a really good picture, looking at the rear and one of the sides. And this is the rear. As you can see, there definitely needs some work done to the structure. And I believe that's the last picture that we have. And Mr. Chairman, you have some pictures on your...
Yeah, well, you're getting those, Jen, maybe I'll...
Okay.
I'll give the commission some background. I received a phone call about a week and a half ago, I guess, from a concerned employee who had heard that that there was a possibility that this structure was going to be demolished. I told her that from what I knew of the building and some previous surveys that we would certainly
like to entertain some discussion about that, if that were in fact the case. We hadn't had a formal application, and in fact, Public Works Board doesn't necessarily have to come to us with that. As part of the Carson City Bypass Project, Nevada Department of Transportation contracted with a architectural firm to do inventories along the alignment. They did find that the Nevada State Prison was eligible to the National Register of Historic Places. A nomination hasn't been put together to date. You can see, I think, if you saw the article in the paper today, with some checking, it appears as though neither Public Works or the prisons are looking at tearing this down. As a matter of fact, they'd like to see it preserved. And what I'd like to do is to have this commission go on record and just kind of reiterate my concerns about it. It is a National Register eligible property. Just from the pictures that we've seen, it's in a terrible state of disrepair. And the longer it stays in that state, the better case you can make for
them. There's no secret balloting. All voting must be done in public. The rule is that it's a majority of the quorum. There's a separate rule for if the public body is all elected officials, and then it's a majority of the entire body. So, for example, if the Board of Supervisors has three members show up, which constitute a quorum, to take action, all three would have to vote on the same side. Whereas in this case, a quorum would be four, and it would be a majority of the quorum to take action for the Historic Resources Commission. We're required to take minutes of the meeting. The minutes are considered to be public records, and they're must be reasonably made available within 30 days, and the meeting must be recorded. That's why it's important to have your mics on when you talk. Does anybody have any questions? If not, that ends my presentation.
Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Next item is F4, HRC 09-027, presentation and action to provide comments to the Nevada State Prison and State Public Works Board, SPWB, regarding the Nevada State Prison Warden's House possible demolition, owner State of Nevada, Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, 3301 East 5th Street, APN 010-041-55. Is that the right property owner? Conservation Natural Resources owns the
I believe so.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I actually have just a few slides that I wanted to go through, and that way then you can do your presentation if that's okay.
Yeah, Jen, if you want, after you're done with yours, if you go to the CD, there's some historic photos too of the prison that the commission might like.
So regarding the subject site, this is the prison property. This is 5th Street, and this is the gate area. And the warden's house is located right in this area. We tried to get an aerial photo to show you where the location of the structure was. But we do have a few pictures. This is of the front of the warden's house. Another picture of the front. And this is a really good picture looking at the rear and one of the sides. And this is the rear. As you can see, there definitely needs some work done to the structure. And I believe that's the last picture that we have. And Mr. Chairman, you have some pictures on your...
Yeah, well, you're getting those, Jen, maybe.
Okay.
I'll give the commission some background. I received a phone call about a week and a half ago, I guess, from a concerned employee who had heard that that there was a possibility that this structure was going to be demolished. I told her that from what I knew of the building and some previous surveys that we would certainly like to entertain some discussion about that, if that were in fact the case. We hadn't had a formal application, and in fact, Public Works Board doesn't necessarily have to come to us with that. As part of the Carson City Bypass Project, Nevada Department of Transportation contracted with a architectural firm to do inventories along the alignment. They did find that the Nevada State Prison was eligible to the National Register of Historic Places. A nomination hasn't been put together to date. You can see, I think, if you saw the article in the paper today, with some checking, it appears as though neither Public Works or the prisons are looking at tearing this down. As a matter of fact, they'd like to see it preserved. And what I'd like to do is to have this commission go on record and just kind of reiterate my concerns about it. It is a National Register eligible property. Just from the pictures that we've seen, it's in a terrible state of disrepair. And the longer it stays in that state, the better case you can make for demolition. As it starts falling apart, it'll be easier to make that case. And I'd like to have the commission in letter form or through public or the minutes and public comment just go on record as suggesting to Public Works and prisons that we start looking at some alternatives for preservation of that and make sure that it does remain. Found some pictures on the internet, historic pictures of the prison. Warm Springs Hotel was actually the first territorial prison, and Abe Curry ended up building the prison soon after they used the back rooms of the hotel as a state prison. This is a picture looking to the, I believe it's to the east of the Warm Springs Hotel and prison. Go ahead. Whoops. I think that one's a good. There's the, you saw on Jennifer's overhead, the slide of the entrance. The warden's house is sitting kind of behind that cupola guard building. You can see it kind of peeking through the ash or elm trees there in the back. That was when, I don't know if any of you have been to the state prison in Boise, the old territorial prison. The architecture and style of this building is real similar to the Idaho State Prison, too. Okay, Jim. And then there's another, here's a view of the prison in 1939. You can see there's a greenhouse out in front, which is kind of a neat addition, too. Again, there's the entrance gate. And I think the other one is just Warm Springs Hotel. Yeah, that's just a close-up of the hotel when it was, when Abe Curry had it. All the buildings out there are quarried of the, or from the sandstone out at the prison. Anyway, that pretty much ends my presentation. I was really gratified to see when Dave Frank called me yesterday and said after talking to prisons and public works that they had no intention of tearing it down. It was a good feeling, but out of respect for the phone call that I got, I did want to bring it to the commission and let the commission and the public know that there may be a threat to this structure. Are there any questions, comments?
I got just a question and a comment. How does this whole attitude change with the uncertainty of the prison itself remaining open?
That's a good question. What I'd love to see is closing the prison, tearing down all the new buildings, and then rehabbing the old ones. I would think if they did close it down, the threat to demolishing this building would increase if there's no funding to keep the prison operating, then.
Just another question so I kind of get a grasp of how this all works. But currently, the grounds are in the control of the Nevada State Prison System, and or is it the state of lands that controls it?
It's Department of Corrections controls the prison. The Public Works Board, or State Public Works, is the one who does maintenance on buildings that the state owns.
So it's essentially the same folks that control the Stewart lands.
Yes, yeah, and that's kind of what I'd like to avoid, is getting into a situation like we had with Stewart a few, maybe 5-6 years ago now, where the state lets things run down and then really have no alternative but to tear it down.
That's kind of why I bring that up, because that's the concern, is that this gets handled just like the Stewart. We come in there and put $100,000 into a rehab on that building, and then they close the prison, and then it just sits there and goes back to.
Yeah, and as part of our, as a certified local government, we do have purview and review capabilities for any properties that are listed on the National Register or are eligible. So we can kind of chime in on coalition. As it starts falling apart, it'll be easier to make that case. And I'd like to have the commission in letter form or through public or the minutes and public comment just go on record as suggesting to Public Works and prisons that we start looking at some alternatives for preservation of that, and make sure that it does remain. Found some pictures on the internet, historic pictures of the prison. Warm Springs Hotel was actually the first territorial prison, and Abe Curry ended up building the prison soon after they used the back rooms of the hotel as a state prison. This is a picture looking to the, I believe it's to the east of the Warm Springs Hotel and prison. Go ahead. Whoops. I think that one's a good. There's the, you saw on Jennifer's overhead, the slide of the entrance. The warden's house is sitting kind of behind that cupola guard building. You can see it kind of peeking through the ash or elm trees there in the back. That was when, I don't know if any of you have been to the state prison in Boise, the old territorial prison. The architecture and style of this building is real similar to the Idaho State Prison, too. Okay, Jim. And then there's another, here's a view of the prison in 1939. You can see there's a greenhouse out in front, which is kind of a neat addition, too. Again, there's the entrance gate. And I think the other one is just Warm Springs Hotel. Yeah, that's just a close-up of the hotel when it was, when Abe Curry had it. All the buildings out there are quarried of the, or from the sandstone out at the prison. Anyway, that pretty much ends my presentation. I was really gratified to see when Dave Frank called me yesterday and said, after talking to prisons and public works, that they had no intention of tearing it down. It was a good feeling, but out of respect for the phone call that I got, I did want to bring it to the commission and let the commission and the public know that there may be a threat to this structure. Are there any questions, comments?
I got just a question and a comment. How does this whole attitude change with the uncertainty of the prison itself remaining open?
That's a good question. What I'd love to see is closing the prison, tearing down all the new buildings, and then rehabbing the old ones. I would think if they did close it down, the threat to demolishing this building would increase if there's no funding to keep the prison operating, then.
Just another question so I kind of get a grasp of how this all works. But currently, the grounds are in the control of the Nevada State Prison System, or is it the state of lands that controls it?
It's Department of Corrections controls the prison. The Public Works Board, or State Public Works, is the one who does maintenance on buildings that the state owns.
So it's essentially the same folks that control the Stewart lands.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'd like to avoid, is getting into a situation like we had with Stewart a few, maybe 5-6 years ago now, where the state lets things run down and then really have no alternative but to tear it down.
That's kind of why I bring that up, because that's the concern, is that this gets handled just like the Stewart. We come in there and put $100,000 into a rehab on that building, and then they close the prison, and then it just sits there and goes back to.
Yeah, and as part of our, as a certified local government, we do have purview and review capabilities for any properties that are listed on the National Register or are eligible. So we can kind of chime in on things that happen out there. But sometimes we have to make sure that the state knows that we want to be a player in this.
So we'd have some weight in having them maintain it if something were to happen where it got rehabilitated.
Yeah, rehabilitated, or if demolition is an alternative, I think we have the right to come to the table and try to do what's best for the resource.
This is Commissioner Bass for the record. It appears to me that the warden's house is in within the secured perimeter of the doubled fence area of the prison. It also looks to me from the photographs I've seen and the aerial views that there's a secondary fence separating the former warden's house from the remainder of the prison facility, but it doesn't look as a high security fence as the perimeter fence. If this building is to be rehabilitated and preserved, could possibly it have some historic significance if we could get it outside the secured perimeter of the fence and with the bypass East 5th Street having public access as a historical part of the prison system and portray the first prison in the territory?
That would be an interesting discussion to have with Department of Corrections and Public Works Board. I'm not sure. It'd be interesting to see what they said about moving that fence and public access that close to the prison perimeter.
Yeah, right? If you see that, the same picture you're referring to, you can see where 5th Street used to just run straight through. And then as they started wondering about the proximity, they put that big bend in it to avoid that. So before, that was right on the main road. So.
Yeah, I would think the best bet would be to try to help the state find some money to rehab it, or at least weatherize it so that we can kind of arrest its decay. And then at some point, if the prison is decommissioned, look at a larger preservation picture and decide how to.
Well, right now they got the labor.
Deal with it. That's.
Really.
That's an interesting thought. Is you've got a labor force there, and it might be an opportunity to.
A good opportunity.
To give them some.
And us.
Some occupational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Training on historic restoration rebuild. Any additional questions, comments? Any public comment?
Yes.
You don't have to sign in again, Gary, but if you could.
Okay, thank you. Gary Kane, and now I'm representing the Carson City Historical Society, of which I'm the president. And I just want to say that we really would like to do anything possible to make sure that this building is preserved. Any kind of, if there's fundraising needed to be done, we'll be happy to do that. We also have a group of workers who can do work on the building as well. Also, if there's any kind of research that needs to be done, we will do whatever it takes to make sure that this building is preserved. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Gary. And I think this commission would be happy to work with you guys to advance that too. Jed?
For the record, Jed Block, I was going through some research, and if Jennifer, if you go back to Commissioner Drew's photos, that center one that has a sandstone eagle, I understand that when they moved, when they built the Eagles Lodge, which would have been the what the northwest corner of the Carson Nugget, when they tore it down, the eagle was on top of it, and they dropped it and broke it into three pieces, and they repaired it, and it's supposed to be at the Eagles Hall now on display here on Fifth Street. So that was one of the things that I guess Abram Curry wanted his eagle out of sandstone or whatever it was. And I have another question. I've been told by a couple correctional officers that there's still parts of the original hotel left. Do you know about any of that, if it's indeed there?
I don't, and part of my reason for looking at the historic photographs was to see if I could kind of figure out where it was and where it might be on things that happen out there. But sometimes we have to make sure that the state knows that we want to be a player in this.
So we'd have some weight in having them maintain it if we were to, if something were to happen where it got rehabilitated.
Yeah, rehabilitated, or if demolition is an alternative, I think we have the right to come to the table and try to do what's best for the resource.
This is Commissioner Bass for the record. It appears to me that the warden's house is in within the secured perimeter of the doubled fence area of the prison. It also looks to me from the photographs I've seen and the aerial views that there's a secondary fence separating the former warden's house from the remainder of the prison facility, but it doesn't look as a high security fence as the perimeter fence. If this building is to be rehabilitated and preserved, could possibly it have some historic significance if we could get it outside the secured perimeter of the fence and with the bypass East 5th Street having public access as a historical part of the prison system and portray the first prison in the territory?
That would be an interesting discussion to have with Department of Corrections and Public Works Board. I'm not sure. It'd be interesting to see what they said about moving that fence and public access that close to the prison perimeter.
Yeah, right? If you see that, the same picture you're referring to, you can see where Fifth Street used to just run straight through. And then as they started wondering about the proximity, that put that big bend in it to avoid that. So before, that was right on the main road. So
yeah, I would think the best bet would be to try to help the state find some money to rehab it, or at least weatherize it so that we can kind of arrest its decay. And then at some point, if the prison is decommissioned, look at a larger preservation picture and decide how to
right now they got the labor.
Deal with that. That's
really,
that's an interesting thought, is you've got a labor force there, and it might be an opportunity to
opportunity
to give them some
and us.
Some occupational training on historic restoration rebuild. Any additional questions, comments? Any public comment? You don't have to sign in again, Gary, but if you could.
Okay, thank you. Gary Kane, and now I'm representing the Carson City Historical Society, of which I'm the president. And I just want to say that we really would like to do anything possible to make sure that this building is preserved. Any kind of, if there's fundraising needed to be done, we'll be happy to do that. We also have a group of workers who can do work on the building as well. Also, if there's any kind of research that needs to be done, we will do whatever it takes to make sure that this building is preserved. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Gary. And I think this commission would be happy to work with you guys to advance that too. Jed?
For the record, Jed Block, I was going through some research, and if Jennifer, if you go back to Commissioner Drew's photos, that center one that has a sandstone eagle, I understand that when they moved, when they built the Eagle's Lodge, which would have been the northwest corner of the Carson Nugget, when they tore it down, the eagle was on top of it, and they dropped it and broke it into three pieces, and they repaired it, and it's supposed to be at the Eagles Hall now on display here on Fifth Street. So that was one of the things that I guess Abram Curry wanted his eagle out of sandstone or whatever it was. And I have another question. I've been told by a couple correctional officers that there's still parts of the original hotel left. Do you know about any of that, if it's indeed there?
I don't, and part of my reason for looking at the historic photographs was to see if I could kind of figure out where it was and where it might be. Without, I mean, it's tough not being able to get on the prison grounds and nose around, but I wear Levi's a lot.
Because there was did you get some of those photos off of aroundcarson.com? Because there's a bunch more on there too. There's some old postcards and actually showing part of the eagle and stuff like that.
What's that website, Rebecca? There's the historic photos.
Is that the National Park Service? Actually might be the archives. I can get it for you. It's basically they've taken Habs hair photographs of some of these historic resources in Carson City and then digitized them, and they're really good quality, and I'll have to get you the address.
Yeah,
Digital Library something or other.
There's a website. I can't remember what it is. Maybe I'll get it to Jennifer and we could post the link on the website or something. But it has a lot of 1950s and 40s photographs of downtown. It's really neat. It's basically the whole western part of the state. There's photos of Reno, Virginia City, Gold Hill. There's some Mound House ones in there. A lot of neat ones of Carson City, motor lodges, and some of the 1930s and 40s pictures of Carson.
I found some pictures of the Historical Society that George Kress with the Highway Department took in 1925. And it's part of the glass negatives that Ron James took out of the garbage, but I'll have those in a couple weeks to show you guys as well, copies of them.
Thanks, Jed. Is there any other public comment? Hearing none, I think what I'd like to do is just forward the minutes of this to Public Works and to the Department of Corrections. So if we could just reflect that in the motion, that'd be great. Entertaining motion.
I'll enter a motion to forward the minutes of this meeting pertaining to the warden's home on the Nevada State Prison Grounds.
A motion, do I have a second?
Second.
Motion and a second, any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
One abstention.
One abstention. Motion carries. Next item is F5, discussion and action to provide comments to the governor regarding funding for the Nevada State Preservation Office. HRC Commissioner Spolda Drews will disclose communication with the National Trust regarding the Nevada budget. Jen, do you want to go, or Lou, are you just going to?
It's not really an update. It's just a notice that I got from the National Trust alerting residents of Nevada that the new budget coming out may drastically cut the Historic Preservation Office budget and reduce the Nevada's heritage and cultural programs. And I just wanted to bring this up to the board for discussion and sort of like we're doing for the state prison house. Basically, provide a forum for our comments to go to the governor or to the commissioners that we are in support of the historic preservation programs and that we are you know, against the reduction in their budget and the reduction of programs such as museum programs and things like that. We understand that historic values associated with unique character of our downtown and residential areas and recognizable cultural traditions. These qualities attract tourists and support a more livable community. Closing museums and cutting heritage programs should not be accepted without a serious discussion about what the loss of what of these programs would really cost the state. So.
Thank you, Lou. Any commission member questions, comments? I'd like to note that I think it's a good idea to provide these comments to the governor. Personal letters, emails to Assembly Ways and Means, and Senate Finance Committee, who are also considering this item, might be appropriate too. I think if there's a continued public response that we'll make sure that CHPO and the whole Cultural Affairs Department gets this kind of funding. I mean, it's tough not being able to get on the prison grounds and yeah, nose around, but I wear Levi's a lot.
Is there did you get some of those photos off of aroundcarson.com? Because there's a bunch more on there too. There's some old postcards and actually showing part of the eagle and stuff like that.
What's that website, Rebecca? There's the historic photos.
Is that the National Park Service? Actually might be the archives. I can get it for you. It's basically they've taken HAPS hair photographs of some of these historic resources in Carson City and then digitized them, and they're really good quality, and I'll have to get you the address.
Yeah,
digital library something or other. So.
There's a website. I can't remember what it is. Maybe I'll get it to Jennifer and we could post the link on the website or something. But it has a lot of 1950s and 40s photographs of downtown. It's really neat. It's basically the whole western part of the state. There's photos of Reno, Virginia City, Gold Hill. There's some Mound House ones in there. A lot of neat ones of Carson City, motor lodges, and some of the 1930s and 40s pictures of Carson.
I found some pictures of the Historical Society that George Kress with the Highway Department took in 1925. And it's part of the glass negatives that Ron James took out of the garbage, but I'll have those in a couple weeks to show you guys as well, copies of them.
Thanks, Jed. Is there any other public comment? Hearing none, I think what I'd like to do is just forward the minutes of this to Public Works and to the Department of Corrections. So if we could just reflect that in the motion, that'd be great. Entertain a motion.
I'll enter a motion to forward the minutes of this meeting pertaining to the warden's home on the Nevada State Prison Grounds.
A motion, do I have a second?
Second.
Motion and a second, any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
One abstention.
One abstention. Motion carries. Next item is F5, discussion and action to provide comments to the governor regarding funding for the Nevada State Preservation Office. HRC Commissioner Spolda Drews will disclose communication with the National Trust regarding the Nevada budget. Jen, do you want to go, or Lou, are you just going to?
It's not really an update. It's just a notice that I got from the National Trust alerting residents of Nevada that the new budget coming out may drastically cut the Historic Preservation Office budget and reduce the Nevada's heritage and cultural programs. And I just wanted to bring this up to the board for discussion and sort of like we're doing for the state prison house. Basically, provide a forum for our comments to go to the governor or to the commissioners that we are in support of the historic preservation programs and that we are you know, against the reduction in their budget and the reduction of programs such as museum programs and things like that. We understand that historic values associated with unique character of our downtown and residential areas and recognizable cultural traditions. These qualities attract tourists and support a more livable community. Closing museums and cutting heritage programs should not be accepted without a serious discussion about what the loss of what of these programs would really cost the state. So.
Thank you, Lou. Any commission member questions, comments? I'd like to note that I think it's a good idea to provide these comments to the governor. Personal letters, emails to Assembly Ways and Means, and Senate Finance Committee, who are also considering this item, might be appropriate too. I think if there's a continued public response that we'll make sure that CHPO and the whole Cultural Affairs Department gets this kind of funding. Any questions, comments?
I would like to invite all the people on the that I share the commission here with to write individually a letter directly to the governor personally. I think in addition to our meeting minutes, a personal letter from each of us as commission members would hold more strength than just a simple packet from the commission itself.
Yeah, we're agendized to provide the comments to the governor, and after Joel's presentation, a little hesitant to add other things, but we could certainly, as individuals, get letters to the assembly too. So I think the motion should be specific to our agendized items. But
that's why my my comment was only a word of encouragement.
Thanks, Rob. Any other questions, comments?
I guess as an action item here, Jen, do you want me to prepare a letter to the governor?
That would be very helpful, and I'll forward it along with the minutes once they are available.
Vote on that for the commission, by the commission?
I think if we make a motion to send this, we'll just assume that that's the cover letter that goes with it. Any other questions, comments? I'll entertain a motion.
Did you ask for a public comment, Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, is there a public comment on this item? If the public would like to write a letter, Jed.
I know that AB 507 has to do with bringing cultural affairs and everything back under the control of the Secretary of State, which I have comments I could make later, but maybe as helpful suggestion, maybe to Ross Miller as well. If indeed that does go through and he becomes in control of that, that might be helpful.
Thank you, Jed. Any other questions, comments, public comment? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Okay. I move to direct staff to forward the public comments and a letter, if it's so provided, public comments by the minutes from this meeting to the governor regarding funding for the Nevada State Historic Preservation Office.
Motion, do I have a second?
Second.
Motion and a second. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
One abstention.
The motion carries with one abstention. Thank you, Lou. Item F6, HRC-09-029, discussion only. It's a presentation of the Virginia and Truckee Railway Reconstruction Project Phase 3 in Lyon County in Carson City. That's okay, Jen. I'll just nod or something. The Federal Highways Commission and Bureau of Land Management, along with State Historic Preservation Office, just approved the cultural resources inventory and background for phase three of the Carson City, or the Virginia and Truckee Railway reconstruction project in Carson City. You can see the old route basically went from Virginia City, or originally went from Virginia City down to the mills in Carson, eventually all the way into Carson City, with a main line going up to Reno. And in the early 1900s, down to Minden. This is a map that shows the route of the phase three alignment. Basically starts, just about at the county line. If you've been on Highway 50, you see that the bridge over Highway 50 is in place. Basically, just after it crosses that bridge, the grade enters Carson City and it's completed just about. There's a township and range between, or township line between 15 and 16 there, where it just about stops now. The grade is. Any questions, comments?
I would like to invite all the people on that I share the commission here with to write individually a letter directly to the governor personally. I think in addition to our meeting minutes, a personal letter from each of us as commission members would hold more strength than just a simple packet from the commission itself.
Yeah, we're agendized to provide the comments to the governor, and after Joel's presentation, a little hesitant to add other things, but we could certainly, as individuals, get letters to the assembly too. So I think the motion should be specific to our agendized items. But
that's why my comment was only a word of encouragement.
Thanks, Rob. Any other questions, comments?
I guess as an action item here, Jen, do you want me to prepare a letter to the governor?
That would be very helpful, and I'll forward it along with the minutes once they are available.
On that for the commission, by the commission?
I think if we make a motion to send this, we'll just assume that's the cover letter that goes with it. Any other questions, comments? I'll entertain a motion.
Did you ask for a public comment, Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, is there a public comment on this item? If the public would like to write a letter, Jed.
I know that AB 507 has to do with bringing cultural affairs and everything back under the control of the Secretary of State, which I have comments I could make later, but maybe as helpful suggestion, maybe to Ross Miller as well. If indeed that does go through and he becomes in control of that, that might be helpful.
Thank you, Jed. Any other questions, comments, public comment? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Okay. I move to direct staff to forward the public comments and a letter, if it's so provided, public comments by the minutes from this meeting to the governor regarding funding for the Nevada State Historic Preservation Office.
Motion, do I have a second?
Second.
Motion and a second. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
One abstention.
The motion carries with one abstention. Thank you, Lou. Item F6, HRC-09-029, discussion only. It's a presentation of the Virginia and Truckee Railway Reconstruction Project Phase 3 in Lyon County in Carson City. That's okay, Jen. I'll just nod or something. The Federal Highways Commission and Bureau of Land Management, along with State Historic Preservation Office, just approved the cultural resources inventory and background for phase three of the Carson City, or the Virginia and Truckee Railway reconstruction project in Carson City. You can see the old route basically went from Virginia City, or originally went from Virginia City down to the mills in Carson, eventually all the way into Carson City, with a main line going up to Reno. And in the early 1900s, down to Minden. This is a map that shows the route of the phase three alignment. Basically starts, just about at the county line. If you've been on Highway 50, you see that the bridge over Highway 50 is in place. Basically, just after it crosses that bridge, the grade enters Carson City and it's completed just about. There's a township and range between, or township line between 15 and 16 there, where it just about stops now. The grade is currently built back into the old alignment that goes through the canyon. It stops there. And the Railway Association or Commission has gotten funding for the next mile of grade through stimulus funds to start bringing the grade down the canyon. This is an historic map. I think you have it in your packets. This is the 1879 map. It shows the grade. It shows the number of quartz mills that were down in the canyon. I think there are about five or six just in this segment of the river canyon that processed mills from Virginia City. The Mexican mill by Empire was actually the first mill on the river. And then I believe the Brunswick mill was next. And before the V&T came, there was a network of roads that were used to haul ore down to the river for processing. Okay. During the archaeological evaluation, we found 83 features along the grade. 61 of those were related to the Virginia and Truckee Railroad grade itself and functioning of the railroad. 22 are related to the mills. There are five mills in the vicinity of the phase three alignment, and six archaeological sites, many of which, I think, just about all of which are historic sites. Up at the north end, there's some prehistoric toolstone quarries that are close to the grade but are impacted. Grade's pretty much characterized by real deep rock cuts. Sections of extensive fills and pretty steep slope side cuts. There's a number of rock retaining walls. The most spectacular on this section of the grade is the Vivian. There was a wall by the Vivian Mill. That wall in the center of the photograph is probably 15 feet, 20 feet high, and a good 100 feet long. It's all dry-laid, hand-stacked rock. There's some smaller walls or retaining walls along the mill or along the grade. We deconstructed one of those rock walls up in American Flat to try to stabilize it, and the engineering was really neat. We were afraid that it was just stacked rock, but there's about every third or fourth course, there are massive stretchers. The wall up in American Flat has got much larger rock than that, but there's big stretchers. The rock faces there are about 4 feet by 2 feet square, and they went back about 4 feet to tie all the other walls in and then the grade was filled on top of them, so they're really stable. That wall is almost perfectly plumb, and it's been sitting there for 130 years. There's a number of culverts. Most of the culverts are like the bottom one. They were placed and are filled in. There were actually three culverts along the grade that are like those top ones. That's a rock-walled rail box culvert. And they built, when they built the grade, they built the walls, laid track over the top, or rail over the top as a deck, and then filled it. That picture in the middle is probably the same kind of a wall, but it collapsed and V&T maintenance crews came in, put a culvert, or a reinforced or a corrugated metal pipe in there to act as drainage. One of the things we found up on the phase of the grade they're constructing now is there were some wooden box culverts that were actually beginning to fill up, and the maintenance workers came and just shoved corrugated pipe in there to keep them open and let the box culverts collapse around it. And that's probably what you're seeing in that middle one, too. Number of mill-related features. This is a chunk of the Brunswick Mill, one of the corners of one of the buildings here that remains. You can see vaguely built back into the old alignment that goes through the canyon. It stops there. And the Railway Commission has gotten funding for the next mile of grade through stimulus funds to start bringing the grade down the canyon. This is an historic map. I think you have it in your packets. This is the 1879 map. It shows the grade. It shows the number of quartz mills that were down in the canyon. I think there are about five or six just in this segment of the river canyon that processed mills from Virginia City. The Mexican mill by Empire was actually the first mill on the river. And then I believe the Brunswick Mill was next. And before the V&T came, there was a network of roads that were used to haul ore down to the river for processing. Okay. During the archaeological evaluation, we found 83 features along the grade. 61 of those were related to the Virginia and Truckee Railroad grade itself and functioning of the railroad. 22 are related to the mills. There are five mills in the vicinity of the phase three alignment and six archaeological sites, many of which, I think, just about all of which are historic sites. Up at the north end, there's some prehistoric toolstone quarries that are close to the grade but are impacted. Grade's pretty much characterized by real deep rock cuts, sections of extensive fills, and pretty steep slope side cuts. There's a number of rock retaining walls. The most spectacular on this section of the grade is the Vivian. There was a wall by the Vivian Mill. That wall in the center of the photograph is probably 15 feet, 20 feet high, and a good 100 feet long. It's all dry-laid, hand-stacked rock. There's some smaller walls or retaining walls along the mill or along the grade. We deconstructed one of those rock walls up in American Flat to try to stabilize it. And the engineering was really neat. We were afraid that it was just stacked rock. But there's about every third or fourth course, there are massive stretchers. The wall up in American Flat has got much larger rock than that. But there's big stretchers. The rock faces there are about 4 feet by 2 feet square. And they went back about 4 feet to tie all the other walls in, and then the grade was filled on top of them, so they're really stable. That wall is almost perfectly plumb, and it's been sitting there for 130 years. There's a number of culverts. Most of the culverts are like the bottom one. They were placed and are filled in. There were actually three culverts along the grade that are like those top ones. That's a rock-walled rail box culvert. And they built, when they built the grade, they built the walls, laid track over the top, or rail over the top as a deck, and then filled it. That picture in the middle is probably the same kind of a wall, but it collapsed, and V&T maintenance crews came in, put a culvert, or a reinforced or a corrugated metal pipe in there to act as drainage. One of the things we found up on the phase of the grade they're constructing now is there were some wooden box culverts that were actually beginning to fill up, and the maintenance workers came and just shoved corrugated pipe in there to keep them open and let the box culverts collapse around it. And that's probably what you're seeing in that middle one, too. Number of mill-related features. This is a chunk of the Brunswick Mill, one of the corners of one of the buildings there that remains. You can see vaguely in that upper historic photograph, corner of the old mill, that is the remains you see there. Merrimack Mill was pretty neat. There was a diversion dam just below Brunswick Mill that brought water down to Merrimack. If you've been on the grade, as you pass the Merrimack Mill and the canyon opens up there, or past the Brunswick Mill, the big flat was basically all of Merrimack Mill. There are still traces. You can see in that lower modern photograph where the river is kind of cascading over those rock walls. That's the old diversion dam. There's a trace of the old mill race. And pretty much that's the modern picture of what's left of the Merrimack Mill. When we did the survey out there, we found a number of the buildings that you see in the central portion of that historic photograph. We found the old foundations out there. There were ore chutes, a number of ore chutes along the river. This is the Eureka Mill trestle and ore chute. This is on the northern portion of the phase three grade. You can see what's left. There's just some old timbers and things like that, and pretty good slopes. But you can tell where the chute and tramways were in the ore boxes. Here's another tramway hopper and railroad mill feature associated with the railroad at the Vivian Mill. This is just to the west of where the big stone wall was. You can see in the upper photograph there's a trace of a tramway. There was a little siding there, and the V&T would come and just dump ore into cars in the tramway. They'd take it down to the hopper and across. And just barely visible in that lower photograph, you can see a trace of the old tramway. Vivian Mill also had a big diversion dam. You see in the upper photograph of the river's kind of channeled over to the south side of the canyon. This, we think, is part of that diversion. It's just to the lower right-hand corner of where the historic photo is right now, but it ties in perfectly with where the dam would have been anchored. It's a real neat, just piled cobble wall that just sits right on a little point bar in the river. Another hopper along the grade. Again, the ore cars would be dumped on the grade, taken by, and the ore taken by tram down to the mills. Okay. This is the Yerington smelter. If you've ever been out there, there's a concrete feature that's pretty well shot up. As a matter of fact, we did the survey there, and I was more concerned, as part of the environmental assessment, I was more concerned about lead contamination around that site than anything else, because it's literally littered with rifle casings, handgun, or there's brass everywhere, there's shotgun casings everywhere. One of the neat parts of this is you can see in that aerial photograph, there's a round spur that's called a balloon track, and the trains used to come in and they'd use that to offload ore at the smelter. And it would pretty much swing around. Not much remains out there, but there is the shot up foundation of the smelter. And the balloon track, or the balloon track grade is still in pretty good condition. Okay, Jen. Basically, as has been the case with most of the VNT reconstruction, most of the features and sites have been avoided. General practice is to put up construction fencing. To reconstruct the grade, all we really need to do is that upper historic photograph, corner of the old mill, that is the remains you see there. Okay. Merrimack Mill was pretty neat. There was a diversion dam just below Brunswick Mill that brought water down to Merrimack. If you've been on the grade, as you pass the Merrimack Mill and the canyon opens up there, or past the Brunswick Mill, the big flat was basically all of Merrimack Mill. There are still traces. You can see in that lower modern photograph where the river is kind of cascading over those rock walls. That's the old diversion dam. There's a trace of the old mill race. And pretty much that's the modern picture of what's left of the Merrimack Mill. When we did the survey out there, we found a number of the buildings that you see in the central portion of that historic photograph. We found the old foundations out there. There were ore chutes, a number of ore chutes along the river. This is the Eureka Mill trestle and ore chute. This is on the northern portion of the phase three grade. You can see what's left. There's just some old timbers and things like that, and pretty good slopes. But you can tell where the chute and tramways were in the ore boxes. Here's another tramway hopper and railroad or mill feature associated with the railroad at the Vivian Mill. This is just to the west of where the big stone wall was. You can see in the upper photograph there's a trace of a tramway. There was a little siding there, and the VNT would come and just dump ore into the into cars in the tramway. They'd take it down to the hopper and across. And just barely visible in that lower photograph, you can see a trace of the old tramway. Vivian Mill also had a big diversion dam. You see in the upper photograph of the river's kind of channeled over to the south side of the canyon. This, we think, is part of that diversion. It's just to the lower right-hand corner of where the historic photo is right now, but it ties in perfectly with where the dam would have been anchored. It's a real neat, just piled cobble wall that just sits right on a little point bar in the river. Another hopper along the grade. Again, the ore cars would be dumped on the grade, taken by, and the ore taken by tram down to the mills. Okay. This is the Yerington smelter. If you've ever been out there, there's a concrete feature that's pretty well shot up. As a matter of fact, we did the survey there, and I was more concerned, as part of the environmental assessment, I was more concerned about lead contamination around that site than anything else, because it's literally littered with rifle casings, handgun, or there's brass everywhere, there's shotgun casings everywhere. One of the neat parts of this is you can see in that aerial photograph, there's a round spur that's called a balloon track, and the trains used to come in and they'd use that to offload ore at the smelter, and it would pretty much swing around. Not much remains out there, but there is the shot up foundation of the smelter, and the balloon track, or the balloon track grade, is still in pretty good condition. Okay, Jen. Basically, as has been the case with most of the D&T reconstruction, most of the features and sites have been avoided. General practice is to put up construction fencing. To reconstruct the grade, all we really need to do is stay, it's about an 18-foot right-of-way that most of the grade can be constructed on. So we place avoidance fencing along features to keep the heavy equipment out of that. There's usually a monitor in place during construction. Several of the buried culverts are shown on some 1900s railroad maps. So we have an idea where they are on the grade, but they've been completely covered by sediment, so we're not sure what they are. So one of the things we do during construction is to monitor excavation there. They're in the drainages, and generally the modern culverts are going to be in the same spot. So we monitor during construction for that, and also monitor to make sure that people stay out of the avoidance areas. On this portion of the grade, there are three locations where they may have to modify some of the historic features. Both of the rail culverts have that potential. At this point, they're not really sure whether they can put a metal pipe in that big open one and then fill around it so they can retain the historic structure. That'll be determined when they get closer to construction. The rock wall at the bottom has collapsed. We took Rebecca Osa out there just before Christmas, and we're trying to let SHPO's office see what kind of engineering problems we had to deal with. That's at least 100% slope below that. And it goes all the way down to the river. It's probably 200 feet above the river right there. And there's really no way to reconstruct that, get the grade on top. So the thought is to try to stabilize the grade in there. They'll save as much of the wall as they can. But some of that's going to have to go. All three of these features will be fully documented according to Historic American Engineering Record Standards. If we do have to remove them to build the railroad. And I think is that it? Yeah. So that's it. That's where we are. Carson City and Story County are both certified local governments, and they were invited to participate in the discussions about or regarding the reconstruction. Both certified governments declined. Both counties have seats on the Railway Commission, and they felt that having that input was enough. So under some circumstances, this board could have been one of the reviewing agencies or consulting agencies for the project. However, Carson City decided not to. That's why this is discussion item only, but just wanted to get you up to date and give you an idea where the railroad was. There's still about $3 million in stimulus funds that are going to help bring it down the canyon a little ways. There's still a good chunk of money needed to bring it all the way into the or through the canyon and get the terminal built. So that's that. Any questions, comments? I suppose I should disclose my role in this too. I'm the archaeologist on the project. We work with another consulting firm, and he's based in Tennessee now, so we're kind of his people on the ground and get to do all the monitoring and all the work on the grade.
That's what it's a nice presentation. Thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you. I think you guys have things in your packet. There is. I'm trying to think if that documentation is available to anybody. I don't think it is, the full packet. But it was a good piece of work, and actually the whole grade is documented in a lot of detail. There's been a lot of good work on all the railroad features that are on that grade. Any questions, comments? Next item is F7, discussion only regarding an update regarding, that's redundant, certified local government grant 32-08-21733, parentheses 3. It's about an 18-foot right-of-way that most of the brick grade can be constructed on. So it place avoidance fencing along features to keep the heavy equipment out of that. There's usually a monitor in place during construction. Several of the buried culverts are shown on some 1900s railroad maps. So we have an idea where they are on the grade, but they've been completely covered by sediment, so we're not sure what they are. So one of the things we do during construction is to monitor excavation there. They're in the drainages, and generally the modern culverts are going to be in the same spot. So we monitor during construction for that, and also monitor to make sure that people stay out of the avoidance areas. On this portion of the grade, there are three locations where they may have to modify some of the historic features. Both of the rail culverts have that potential. At this point, they're not really sure whether they can put a metal pipe in that big open one and then fill around it so they can retain the historic structure. That'll be determined when they get closer to construction. The rock wall at the bottom has collapsed. We took Rebecca Osa out there just before Christmas, and we're trying to let SHPO's office see what kind of engineering problems we had to deal with. That's at least 100% slope below that, and it goes all the way down to the river. It's probably 200 feet above the river right there, and there's really no way to reconstruct that, get the grade on top. So the thought is to try to stabilize the grade in there. They'll save as much of the wall as they can, but some of that's going to have to go. All three of these features will be fully documented according to Historic American Engineering Record Standards. If we do have to remove them to build the railroad. And I think is that it? Yeah. So that's it. That's where we are. Carson City and Story County are both certified local governments, and they were invited to participate in the discussions about or regarding the reconstruction. Both certified governments declined. Both counties have seats on the Railway Commission, and they felt that having that input was enough. So. Under some circumstances, this board could have been one of the reviewing agencies or consulting agencies for the project. However, Carson City decided not to. That's why this is discussion item only, but just wanted to get you up to date and give you an idea where the railroad was. There's still about $3 million in stimulus funds that are going to help bring it down the canyon a little ways. There's still a good chunk of money needed to bring it all the way into the or through the canyon and get the terminal built. So that's that. Any questions, comments? I suppose I should disclose my role in this too. I'm the archaeologist on the project. We work with another consulting firm, and he's based in Tennessee now, so we're kind of his people on the ground and get to do all the monitoring and all the work on the grade.
That's what I say. Nice presentation. Thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you. I think you guys have things in your packet. There is. I'm trying to think if that documentation is available to anybody. I don't think it is, the full packet, but it was a good piece of work, and actually the whole grade is documented in a lot of detail. There's been a lot of good work on all the railroad features that are on that grade. Any questions, comments? Next item is F7, discussion only regarding an update regarding, that's redundant, certified local government grant 32-08-21733, parentheses 3, Carson City Mid-Century Survey, Phase 2, Carson City Context and Training Opportunities for the HRC and Residents of the Historic District. Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you're aware, Diana Painter was before you last month and gave you an update regarding the work that she has been conducting. And basically, Diana was able to survey all the properties in the phase two work that has been identified, and planning division staff, we've done some of the data collection as far as getting information from the assessor's data, and also Diana Painter has been in contact with us pretty much on a every other day basis, requesting information for regarding some of the properties. So at this point, we're getting her all the information she's requested, and I believe she's going to have another trip here to Carson City, I think within the next couple weeks, and at that time, hopefully we'll have a draft for you to take a look at, and we'll see, but I believe in the next couple weeks she'll be back to complete the work, and I believe you met with Diana Painter for some time, and if you wanted to address what you discussed.
Sure. Yeah, actually the day after the meeting, Diane stopped by my office and picked up, trying to remember when we had a CLG grant to integrate some of the parcel data and kind of do a GIS overlay of the district. And I gave her some GIS maps that actually showed development by decades. From the core of the historic district out, so she's got those to play with. Kind of clarified some of the things we were looking at in terms of historic context and kind of what our goals for that were. So it was a real production. She probably spent an hour and a half talking with me about this project and picking my brain and grabbing some of the archival materials we had that we'd put together for some of the other CLG grants. So you should be armed and dangerous.
And that's basically the update from the planning staff. We'll be submitting a quarterly report to the SHPO office within the next couple weeks, as we're required to do. And we'll continue to assist Diana Painter. And we're also working for the training opportunities for you, which I'll touch on during planning division staff reports.
Any questions of Jennifer? Move to G, staff reports, non-action items. G1, commissioner reports or comments? Planning division staff report to the commission.
Mr. Chairman, I have a a few things just to add. Just wanted to remind everyone that May is Historic Preservation Month, and Rebecca also provided us with some handouts and also some posters for you this evening, so hopefully before you leave, you'll be able to get one of the posters and one of the handouts. But I also wanted to give you copies of the events. There's multiple events that are planned in the state of Nevada for the month of May. You can go to the SHPO website, and all of the events are noted on the website. I tried to print them out for you as well, but they are available on the SHPO website. But specifically, events that I wanted to point out to you this evening were, there will be an item before the Board of Supervisors for a proclamation regarding Historic Preservation Month, and that'll be on May 7th. Mr. Chairman, hopefully you'll be able to attend that. Also, you will have a HRC meeting on May 14th, and the Historic Preservation Awards will be handed out on May 21st, and that'll be at the Board of Supervisors as well. That'll be at 8:30 a.m. The Waterhouse property, as well as Mayor Texera, will be receiving awards. And lastly, the date that I'd like to note is the presentation that Mr. Lambert will be providing to you members, as well as the general public, and that'll be on May 28th at 5:30. It's also on the schedule of events, and that's going to be in the performance hall at the BAC. And
Carson City Mid-Century Survey Phase 2, Carson City Context and Training Opportunities for the HRC and Residents of the Historic District. Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you're aware, Diana Painter was before you last month and gave you an update regarding the work that she has been conducting. And basically, Diana was able to survey all the properties in the phase two work that has been identified, and Planning Division staff, we've done some of the data collection as far as getting information from the assessor's data, and also Diana Painter has been in contact with us pretty much on a every other day basis, requesting information for regarding some of the properties. So at this point, we're getting her all the information she's requested, and I believe she's going to have another trip here to Carson City, I think within the next couple weeks, and at that time, hopefully we'll have a draft for you to take a look at, and we'll see, but I believe in the next couple weeks she'll be back to complete the work. And I believe you met with Diana Painter for some time, and if you wanted to address what you discussed.
Sure. Yeah, actually the day after the meeting, Diane stopped by my office and picked up, trying to remember when we had a CLG grant to do some, to integrate some of the parcel data and kind of do a GIS overlay of the district. And I gave her some GIS maps that actually showed development by decades from the core of the historic district out, so she's got those to play with. Kind of clarified some of the things we were looking at in terms of historic context and kind of what our goals for that were. So it was a real production. She probably spent an hour and a half talking with me about this project and picking my brain and grabbing some of the archival materials we had that we'd put together for some of the other CLG grants. So you should be armed and dangerous.
And that's basically the update from the planning staff. We'll be submitting a quarterly report to the SHPO office within the next couple of weeks, as we're required to do. And we'll continue to assist Diana Painter. And we're also working for the training opportunities for you, which I'll touch on during Planning Division staff reports.
Any questions of Jennifer? Move to G, staff reports, non-action items. G1, commissioner reports or comments? Planning Division staff report to the commission.
Mr. Chairman, I have a few things just to add. Just wanted to remind everyone that May is Historic Preservation Month, and Rebecca also provided us with some handouts and also some posters for you this evening, so hopefully before you leave, you'll be able to get one of the posters and one of the handouts. But I also wanted to give you copies of the events. There's multiple events that are planned in the state of Nevada for the month of May. You can go to the SHPO website, and all of the events are noted on the website. I tried to print them out for you as well, but they are available on the SHPO website. But specifically, events that I wanted to point out to you this evening were, there will be an item before the Board of Supervisors for a proclamation regarding Historic Preservation Month, and that'll be on May 7th. Mr. Chairman, hopefully you'll be able to attend that. Also, you will have a HRC meeting on May 14th, and the Historic Preservation Awards will be handed out on May 21st, and that'll be at the Board of Supervisors as well. That'll be at 8:30 a.m. The Waterhouse property, as well as Mayor Texera, will be receiving awards. And lastly, the date that I'd like to note is the presentation that Mr. Lambert will be providing to you members, as well as the general public, and that'll be on May 28th at 5:30. It's also on the schedule of events, and that's going to be in the performance hall at the BAC. And again, that's regarding John Lambert. The planning division, we will be sending notices to every property owner in the historic district. It'll also be noted on the HRC website regarding this free presentation that Mr. Lambert will be providing regarding masonry preservation. So those are the events that I wanted to note. Also, there are two items that have been submitted for your meeting in May, one fencing item and also a window replacement for 108 North Minnesota Street. Dave Frank from the Nevada Appeal has been in contact with the Planning Division. They'd like to do a story regarding the preservation awards, and so they'll be contacting you, Mr. Chairman. And I also just wanted to note that this is the first month that the information regarding your agenda is available on the HRC website, and we'll continue to get that information on the website. We're trying to improve the website as we speak, and so we're just going to continue to work on it, but this is the first month the information has been available on the website.
Thanks, Jen. If we have large plan sets, are those, can those be scanned and put on the website too?
Yes, actually the Public Works Department, and that's the department that the Planning Division is under, as well as Engineering and the Building Department, we're in a large effort to digitize all of our files and all of our plans. And actually the Engineering Division has a large scanner, and they're in the process of scanning all of their large plans. So I personally don't know how to use the large scanner yet. But we do have the capabilities to scan the large maps, and we will do that for the HRC agenda.
Thank you, Jen. Any future agenda items from the commission?
Can I just ask a question relevant to the future? I'm not sure it's an agenda item. It's just a procedural question, and that is, I've noticed I, for one, never identify myself when I speak up, and Jennifer's very compulsive about it, and our newest commissioner, for the record, would say you're who is talking, et cetera. Should we all be encouraged to do that? Is it better for record keeping, minutes, et cetera?
It is. It definitely is.
Thanks, Dar. Now we have something else to remember.
Sorry about that, team.
Any other items under staff report? Hearing none, I'll move to H, action on adjournment. Entertain a motion.
Adjourned.
You have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you.